Chapter 22, The Lie of Fossil Transitions.
Dr. Eric Pionka gave a speech to the Texas Academy of Science last month in which he advocated the need to exterminate 90% of the population through the airborne Ebola virus. Standing in front of a slide of human skulls, Pionka gleefully advocated this virus as his preferred method of extermination, choosing it over AIDS because of its faster kill period. Ebola victims suffer the most tortuous deaths imaginable as the virus kills by liquefying the internal organs. The body literally dissolves as the victim writhes in pain, bleeding from every orifice. Pionka also suggests that we should begin to sterilize the human population now, saying that we need to sterilize everybody on the earth and make the antidote freely available to anyone willing to work for it. And believe it or not, not only was Pionka later presented with a Distinguished Scientist Award by the Academy, but amazingly, the audience of fellow scientists and students actually applauded, cheered, and laughed approvingly. And Pionka is no crackpot. He has given lectures to prestigious universities worldwide where he is merely echoing the elite's hideous interest in depopulation techniques via Darwinist control mechanisms. Dr. Forrest Mims, who has been valiantly trying to expose Pionka's hideous calls, wrote to Pionka and asked for an explanation as to why he wanted to see a worldwide epidemic that would only kill Africans. Pionka responded by saying he was not racially prejudiced and wanted to see 90% of all races exterminated. As he puts it, he wants an equal opportunity killer virus. Dr. Mims rightfully concluded that the only difference between Pionka and Hitler is that Hitler stated he wanted to kill 5.5 million people. This guy is saying he wants to kill 5.5 billion people.
Now folks, how many of you like to have that guy as your teacher? You'd learn real fast not to smart off to him, wouldn't you? But seriously, come on, can you believe what he's saying? He actually says annihilating 90% of the world's population is a good thing. Excuse me? And folks, it's one thing to think that, but here's my point. What did it say he was receiving his influence from? From Darwinian evolution, right? And folks, lest you think he's the only one being influenced like that, he's not alone. This deadly Darwinian influence is everywhere.
Margaret Sanger called for the elimination of human weeds, for the cessation of charity because it prolonged the lives of the unfit, for the segregation of morons, misfits, and the maladjusted, and for the sterilization of genetically inferior races. David Graeber, a research biologist with the National Park Service, said, "We have become a plague upon ourselves and upon the earth. Until such time as Homo sapiens should decide to rejoin nature, some of us can only hope for the right virus to come along." Jacques Cousteau wrote, "The damage people cause to the planet is a function of demographics, it is equal to the degree of development. One American burdens the earth much more than 20 Bangladeshes, this is a terrible thing to say. In order to stabilize world population, we must eliminate 350,000 people per day. It is a horrible thing to say, but it's just as bad not to say it." Bertrand Russell wrote, "At present the population of the world is increasing, war so far has had no great effect on this increase. I do not pretend that birth control is the only way in which population can be kept from increasing. There are others. If a black death could be spread throughout the world once in every generation, survivors could procreate freely without making the world too full, the state of affairs might be somewhat unpleasant, but what of it? Really high-minded people are indifferent to suffering, especially that of others." Dr. Sam Keen, a New Age writer and philosopher, stated, "We must speak far more clearly about sexuality, contraception, about abortion, about values that control the population, because the ecological crisis, in short, is the population crisis. Cut the population by 90% and there aren't enough people left to do a great deal of ecological damage." Ted Turner said, "People who abhor the China one-child policy are dum-dums. A total population of 250 to 300 million people, a 95% decline from present levels, would be ideal."
Now folks, I don't know about you, but at this rate, hey, we need to stop calling evolution, evolution, and start calling it what it is. It's evolution, you know what I'm saying? It's spawning something, all right, it's spawning death. And people, that's exactly why we're going to continue in our study, The Witness of Creation. And so far, we've seen the first two evidences of creation that God has left behind for us, showing that He's not just real, but that we really can have a personal, intimate relationship with Him. The creator of the universe was the evidences of an intelligent creation from the very hand of Almighty God, as opposed to blind chance exploding from some sort of primeval blob, and then a young creation, as opposed to the long-age fairy tale time of evolution. And in the last five chapters we've seen how the third evidence was a special creation. And so far, we've not only seen how the supposed evolution of people and animals and natural selection and embryology are a bunch of baloney, but in the last chapter we saw how mutations and vestigial organs are also a bunch of baloney. Why? Because they have some serious problems. Problems with the theories, problems with the evidence, and problems with the quotes. Folks, they not only know it's a lie, but they keep using these lies for evolution. And gee whiz, folks, I got to thinking, man, if all you've got are lies to support your theory, then maybe it's time to get a new theory, you know what I'm saying? But you might be thinking, okay, so maybe the supposed evolution of people and animals and all these mechanisms of evolution are a bunch of baloney, but what about the latest ones they've come up with? You know, like transitional fossils and punctuated equilibrium, where this is modern proof for evolution taking place. What about those? Well, hey, great question. But before we look at that, let's once again get acquainted with the biblical answer for the existence of life.
Colossians 1:13-17. For he has rescued us from the dominion of darkness and brought us into the kingdom of the Son he loves, in whom we have redemption, the forgiveness of sins. He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation. For by him all things were created, things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or powers or rulers or authorities, all things were created by him and for him. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together.
Now folks, according to our text, the Bible is clear. Jesus is not only God in the flesh, but he's what? He's also the one who created all of flesh, right? From the visible to the invisible, from the heavens to the humans, right? But the problem is, what does evolution teach? Do they say, oh yeah, Jesus created all things and even holds them together? Are you kidding? They say blind chance created all things and pure luck holds it together, right? Therefore, I'd say we better look at not just the scriptural evidence but the scientific evidence of these latest theories of evolution and see just who's telling the truth. How about you? And we'll start with transitional fossils. Here's how the basic premise goes. Evolutionists believe that over millions and billions of years there have been millions and billions of evolutionary changes in creatures. And they call each one of these supposed changes in a creature a transition. And each one of these transitions is supposedly, slowly over time, changing the creature into a completely different kind of creature. And for proof, they say you can see evidence of this in the fossil record. So, my question is this? Is this really true? Are millions and billions of transitions over millions and billions of years what really brought life into being? Are you kidding? People, it's another evolutionary lie. How do I know? Because the first reason we know Jesus created all of life is that transitional fossils are a lie. People, we're going to look at some serious problems with these supposed transitional fossils, and you tell me if somebody's brain hasn't fossilized.
Problem of what we find. Believe it or not, many evolutionists believe that the modern bat evolved over millions of years undergoing millions of transitions from a rat-like creature. In fact, the German name for bat is Fledermaus, which means flying mice. But let's take a look at what we should expect to find if this transition from a rat to a bat were to have occurred. Imagine for a moment we started off with one creature, the rat, and actually ended up with a new creature, the bat. First of all, stop and think about how many millions of supposed transitions there would have to be over millions of years to change from a rat to the bat. Therefore, of all the fossil remains, we should expect to find millions of these leftover remains of each of these millions of transitions, right? However, the only problem is, that's not what we find. Out of the millions and billions of transitional fossils that should be there are none, zero, nada. That which should be the most in abundance, is that which we do not find at all. Exactly opposite of what the theory of transitions implies.
Problem of what we see. It's bad enough that we do not find any of these supposed transitional fossils, and the few they've tried to come up with, like the horse and whale we've already seen, are completely phony. Keep in mind the whole premise is that you start off with one unique creature that supposedly turns into a totally different creature altogether. However, the only problem is, that's not what we see. Take for example a horseshoe crab fossil from the supposed Ordovician age said to be 450-million a year old. Now, it was already demonstrated in the book A Young Creation that we've only been around for a few thousand years, but even giving the evolutionists their big dates, they've still got a huge problem. The problem is that this fossil is no different from horseshoe crabs today. Why haven't they long since transitioned into something else? Or how about a starfish fossil touted by evolutionists to be 100 to 150 million years old? But guess what? It's the same as starfish today. Or how about some oyster fossils said to be over 400 million years old? But again, they are no different than oysters today. How about a supposed 1.9 million a year old fossil bacterium from Western Ontario in Canada? The only problem is it has the same structure as bacteria living today. Or consider the oldest known fossil scorpion found in East Kirkton in Scotland. This species is said to be 320 million years old, but for some reason is still no different from today's scorpions. Or how about an insect fossil in amber that was found on the Baltic Sea coast and dated by evolutionists at about 170 million years old? But for some reason, it's no different from its modern-day counterparts. How about a supposed 140 million year old dragonfly fossil found in Bavaria in Germany? Believe it or not, it's identical to dragonflies living today. Or how about some supposed 35-million-year-old flies? But guess what? They have the same body structure as flies today. Or how about a supposed 170-million-year-old fossil shrimp from the supposed Jurassic age? But once again, it's no different from shrimp today. Or consider the supposed 25-million-year-old termite fossils found in amber. Can you believe they are identical to termites living today? Therefore, the point is this. If these creatures supposedly existed millions of years ago, because of evolution, then surely also, because of evolution, they would have made a transition into another creature by now, right? However, that's not what we see. Out of the millions of fossil remains we do see, all we ever see are more of the same kind of creatures. Some may have gone extinct, but none of them have ever turned into another kind. Exactly opposite of what the theory of transitions implies.
Problem of what we hear. Number 1. Robert Carroll, an expert on vertebrate paleontology and a committed evolutionist, despite more than 100 years of intense collecting efforts since the time of Darwin's death, the fossil record still does not yield the picture of infinitely numerous transitional links that he expected. Number 2. Biologist Francis Hitching. If we find fossils, and if Darwin's theory was right, we can predict what the rock should contain. Finely graduated fossils leading from one group of creatures to another group of creatures at a higher level of complexity. But this is hardly ever the case. In fact, the opposite holds true. Darwin felt, though, that the extreme imperfection of the fossil record was simply a matter of digging up more fossils. But as more and more fossils were dug up, it was found that almost all of them were very close to current living animals. Number 3. Stephen Jay Gould, a Harvard University paleontologist and well-known evolutionist, the history of most fossil species include two features particularly inconsistent with gradualism. Most species exhibit no directional change during their tenure on Earth. They appear in the fossil record looking much the same as when they disappear. A species does not arise gradually by the steady transformation of its ancestors. It appears all at once and fully formed. Number 4. Niles Eldridge said that individual kinds of fossils remain recognizably the same throughout the length of their occurrence in the fossil record had been known to paleontologists long before Darwin published his Origin. 120 years of paleontological research later, it has become abundantly clear that the fossil record will not confirm this part of Darwin's predictions. Nor is the problem a miserably poor record. The fossil record simply shows that this prediction is wrong.
Now folks, I don't know about you, but I'd say based on the evidence we just saw, somebody needs to make a transition, all right. They need to make a transition to the brain cell center, you know what I'm saying? And gee, that would make evolution by way of transitional fossils a what? A lie. Shocker. Oh, but that's not all. The second reason we know Jesus created all of life is because punctuated equilibrium is a lie. People, believe it or not, even after all we've seen, the evolutionists still will not admit defeat. No matter how many times they get caught making up stories, they just keep making up more stories. And one of the biggest ones to date is called punctuated equilibrium. And folks, all it is a fancy way of saying, okay, maybe the reason why we can't find any transitional fossils is because evolution didn't happen slowly over time but rapidly. Maybe it happened quickly in spontaneous burps. For instance, maybe the first bird hatched from a reptile's egg. And folks, I'm not making that up. That's really what this theory says. So, my question is this. Is punctuated equilibrium really true? Did a crocodile really give birth to a crow? Are you kidding? People, it's another evolutionary lie. We're going to take a look at some serious problems with this punctuated equilibrium thing, and you tell me if somebody hasn't been punched one too many times.
Problem of multiple mutations. If punctuated equilibrium were to ever occur, then millions and billions of mutations have to suddenly all at once to produce a new and totally different, spontaneous creature, like the bird hatching from a reptile's egg. However, what we observe is that if a mutation does occur, it is single and not multiple. If they occur, they happen one at a time, not millions at a time.
Problem of beneficial mutations. Not only would millions of mutations have to happen all at once if punctuated equilibrium were to ever occur, but keep in mind every single one of these mutations must be beneficial to the organism. First of all, the odds of multiple mutations ever working together in harmony with all body parts simultaneously, such as the body organs, bones, head, feet, DNA, and all the rest, are beyond reason. But secondly, as we've already seen, all we ever observe with mutations is that they are never beneficial but detrimental. They either hurt, harm, maim, or kill the creature. As one evolutionist put it, these monsters are not hopeful but hopeless.
Problem of time. If mutations could possibly be multiple and beneficial, even Stephen Jay Gould admitted that these are hopeful monsters of punctuated equilibrium occur only every 50,000 years to help cover up the fact that they are not occurring today. But do the math on this. One new species every 50,000 years would only yield 20 new species every 1 million years. But what we observe is that there are hundreds of thousands of plant and animal species on the Earth. Therefore, all eternity itself could not provide enough time for all these creatures to spring forth.
Problem of multiple creatures. Even if mutations were multiple and beneficial, and there was enough time for punctuated equilibrium to occur, keep in mind that two of these spontaneous events must come about simultaneously. This is because if this new creature is to survive, there must be one male and one female. Then they have to appear on the scene close enough to find each other. Then they have to get interested in each other, and hope the other one wants to marry them and have kids. And as if that wasn't a big enough feat, keep in mind what Gould said, that this rare event only happens once every 50,000 years. Question: who's going to wait around 50,000 before they get married and have kids, let alone stay alive to have kids?
Problem with the evidence. Believe it or not, not only are there known problems with the theory of punctuated equilibrium, but it is also known by the evolutionists that there is no evidence whatsoever to back it up. For instance, Ernst Mayr, who's been called the Dean of Darwinism, said, "To believe that such a drastic mutation would produce a viable new type is equivalent to believing in miracles. The finding of a suitable mate for that hopeless monster, and the establishment of reproductive isolation from the normal members of the parental population seem to me insurmountable difficulties."
Now folks, I don't know about you, but I'd say based on the evidence we just saw, somebody's equilibrium needs to get punctuated, all right. They need a serious dose of laying on of hands, you know what I'm saying? And gee whiz, that would make evolution by way of punctuated equilibrium a what? A lie. Shocker. Oh, but that's still not all. The third reason we know Jesus created all of life is because sequential ordering is a lie. People, even if transitional fossils or punctuated equilibrium were true, and they're not, but even if they were, it still doesn't prove a thing. Why? Because stop and think about it. If you find a bone in the dirt, all you know about it is what? It died, right? You don't know anything else. You don't know if it had any kids, let alone what kind of kids, right? Therefore, you can put any kind of bones in any kind of supposed sequential order you want, but it still doesn't prove a thing. And to show you how goofy this sequential ordering really is, let's look at just a couple of problems with it.
Problem with family trees. The only problem with all those seemingly well-ordered evolutionary family trees in the textbooks is they're completely out of order. And not sequentially, but in honesty. Believe it or not, all these so-called transitional family trees cited as visual proof for evolution are not only pure poppycock, they're admitted as such by the evolutionists. For instance, even evolutionist Stephen Jay Gould said, "The evolutionary trees that adorn our textbooks have data only at the tips and nodes of their branches. The rest is inference, however reasonable, not the evidence of fossils." And evolutionist Mary Leakey said, "All of those trees of life with the branches of our ancestors, that's a lot of nonsense." And finally, in an article in the leading journal Science, in the years after Darwin, his advocates hoped to find predictable progressions. In general, these have not been found yet. The optimism has died hard, and some pure fantasy has crept into textbooks.
Problem with the whole idea. To put the nail in the coffin, so to speak, with this whole idea of sequential ordering, listen to this humorous analogy revealing how there's no way this ordering of bones can be used as proof for evolution. As you will see, sequential ordering is so bogus that you can use it to create the so-called evolution of just about anything, including plastic silverware. He says, "Just because you can arrange animals in a certain order doesn't prove a thing. Even if you find them buried in a certain order, that doesn't prove a thing. If I get buried on top of a hamster, does that prove he's my grandpa? I've been doing a lot of research on the evolution of the fork. I've pieced together fragmentary evidence for years. I believe, after intensive research, the knife evolved first, and then slowly evolved into the spoon. It took millions of years with great geological pressures that squeezed, dished it out and widened it up a little bit. And then, slowly, erosion cut grooves into the end and turned it into the short tine fork. And then, very slowly over millions of years, the grooves got longer and wider until it turned into the long tine fork. I knew I had the right order, but I felt like I had a missing link, particularly between spoons and forks. You see, spoons are rounded and have no grooves, but forks are squared and grooved. That's two jumps in one. Even punctuated equilibrium can't do that. So, I knew I had a missing link, but I couldn't find it. Until one day I'm flying in an airplane on US Air 30,000 feet off the ground, and a stewardess walked down the aisle and handed me the missing link. I don't think she knew what she had. But my trained scientific eye picked it up. I said, "This is it." Then later that day I went to get some chicken for lunch and found another one. There they are, folks, the missing links, sporks. So now the evolution of silverware is becoming complete. All I need to do is apply for a $10 million grant, and I think I can wrap this up. I've found a lot of evidence since then. I've been gathering data on this for a long time. I've even found some mutants along the way in melted plastic forks. They didn't quite make it for some reason. You know, it was very interesting, though. As soon as people found out that I was doing research on the evolution of the fork, everybody wanted to become famous. They sent me all their data from all over the country. Even some lies got sent to me. One of them was an obvious fake. It was a fork head on a spoon handle. It didn't get by me, though. This is a cutthroat business. This fossil business is dangerous, you know, you have to watch them. But I caught it right away. It's not in my museum. The rest of them are, though. Now look, you can arrange letters in order and try to prove something if you want. You can turn a cat to a cot to a dog, making one letter change at a time. If you play around for a while, you can turn yourself into a fool. Doesn't take long either.
Now, how many of you are going to take a closer look at your silverware today when you go out to lunch? Hey, you might find a missing link, alright, maybe it's a piece of sausage on the end of your fork. In fact, I was thinking about messing with the evolutionist minds by having my wife bury me on top of my two wiener dogs. Boy, that'd mess them up, wouldn't it? Hopefully she'd do it after I'm dead. But seriously, as you can see, even if all that other stuff about a gradual or rapid evolution were true, and it's not, the whole premise of sequential ordering still doesn't prove a thing, does it? Not at all. In fact, Charles Darwin actually said,
"If it could be demonstrated that any complex organism existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous, successive, slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down."
And folks, I don't know about you, but I'd say based upon what we've seen in this chapter, let alone the last five, I'd say old Charlie's theory of evolution has just what? By his own admission, it just broke down, didn't it? But you might be thinking, okay, so maybe all these supposed evolutionary mechanisms for the existence of life are a bunch of baloney and hold no bearing on a special creation, but speaking of life, this means that the only option, then, is that God has to be the author of life. But if the Genesis account of God being the creator of all life really can be taken literally, as we've seen through the evidences of an intelligent creation, a young creation, and a special creation, then does that mean we can also take literally the Genesis account of God judging the whole world for their wickedness with a worldwide flood? I mean, did a guy named Noah and his family really exist, let alone really build an actual giant ark that housed two of every kind of creature on the earth, enabling them to survive a global catastrophe? Well, hey, great question. I guess that's why we're going to begin a new section called A Judged Creation, in the days of Noah. Did God really judge the whole world with a global flood and only save those who got into his boat? And more importantly, is God really going to judge the world again, this time with a global firestorm, and only those who get into his son will be saved? I guess we'll get to that in the next book.